You are listening to Radio Albion.
Welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and what we specialize here in this series of lectures is understanding the world, especially Russia and Ukraine, from an Orthodox point of view, and especially as it comes to defending the Russian monarchy and monarchy in general. We're coming to the very end of March. By the time you are hearing this, it will be April. We're in the middle of Lent. And this show, this series, functions largely by donations. And all the links are in the description as to how you can do that. And, of course, my Patreon and all the rest, where I'm constantly writing and publishing. Now, while I've dealt with this topic before, I've not analyzed it in such a specific way. We're talking about the infamous ritual murder issue, especially in Russia. A few years ago, I did an analysis of Ariel Toaff's book, Jewish Professor in Israel, which gives a great degree of credence to the notion of ritual murder. This, and that was a much more general treatment. Tonight we're going to deal with the case of Andrei Yushchinsky from Kiev, a 13-year-old, murdered by a man named Belis. His body was discovered March 20th, 1911, in Zagorovsina, in one of the caves. He was actually murdered on March 12th, 1911. He was captured, actually kidnapped by Belis and several other Jews in the territory of a brick-making factory owned by Jews that had a small secret synagogue within it. The body had been totally desanguinated. All the wounds, especially that penetrated the bone to the skull and the brain, were torn with great skill. He was still alive, according to the autopsy, when this happened. He was standing, and it was done with a great degree of precision, using tools that you might use in shoemaking. 13 injections just in the right side of the temporal region were made with something like a sewing needle, and his mouth was clamped shut. His hands were tied behind his back, thrown out just before Jewish Passover. And very quickly did you develop suspicion. Little Andrei, and Drusha is the diminutive, because he was so young, we could call him that, who, despite his age, was already a student at the theological school and was pretty much universally liked. He was very affectionate, he was humble, he was obedient. Even among his peers, he really had no personal enemies. One of his goals was to become a priest at one point after his studies were over. Mendel Belis was the man accused, among others. And the trial was an absolute disaster. Bribery, media manipulation, all the preliminary stories that these Jews told were dismissed, and contradictory. Vera Cheperikova had three children, and they saw Andrusha kidnapped by Bielis. Most of them died unexpectedly. In fact, most of the witnesses died mysteriously before they could testify. Quickly, after the arrest and everything started progressing, the entire scene of the crime, the factory, and everything else burned to the ground. Investigation prior to any trial lasted about 2 years. The jury, who was split on this, clearly recognized the fact that he was murdered, that he was tortured to death, but it certainly didn't proclaim his innocence. They claimed that there was insufficient direct evidence, for good reason here. Most of the witnesses were dead. The jury ultimately was divided 6-6. Father Fyodor Sienkiewicz, who was the son of the woman who eventually was accused, at least by the Jews, Vera, as I mentioned already, did see Bielis drag Andrusha away. Very quickly, the Jews responded. And in fact, the response is still going on. The huge spread of worldwide lies and slander, all manner of bribery, every crime you can consider. Needless to say, Lenin and Trotsky took this as a core element in their ideology. A guy by the name of Tager, both in the Soviet Union and in the West, is one of the mainstream leaders in this. Let me quote him here. "None of the last reigns, that is to say of the Russian monarchy, knew such an abundance of attempts to initiate ritual affairs as during the reign of Nicholas II. They're all objectively a kind of historical rehearsal, a historical test of strength before the unfolding of the Kiev process, legal process. The Vladimir case of 1897, Vilna case, 1901, the Dubosary case, 1903, Smolensk, 1910, etc., are the forerunners of the Bielis trial. The Besk-Taiga cases are the last remnants of these ritual claims." Now, he doesn't mention any ritual element, the murder of Tsar Nicholas, but he admits, despite himself, that the murder of Yushchinsky was not something out of the ordinary. But it did lead to a mobilization of everything, all of the forces hostile to Russia and Orthodoxy. And it was a watershed event in mobilizing the world's Jews against the Crown of Russia. The significance here really can't be overestimated. Here you have, in the modern world, a question of Jewish ritual murder within the confines of what's supposed to be an open, transparent, adversarial legal process. And it wasn't even the biggest problem right off the bat, well, other than witnesses dying, is that there was no ritual murder crime in the Russian code of law, criminal legislation. There was no crime of this kind. But given the signs of this being liturgical, you did have some surviving witnesses that the Jews perceived this as a huge threat. Over and over again, the slogan was, "It is not Bielis who is accused, but the entire Jewish people." Now, let me, before I get deeper into this, I want to give a rundown of the evidence. Now, I took this from a few different sources. One source is actually from the prosecutor, his closing statement. The testimony of the children is chief among these. Zinya, Valya, Ludmila, they were playing there. They said Bielis, together with two other Jews, a guy by the name of Schneerson, they're from a famous family of Hasidim. was identified, and they dragged Andrushka away. And then according to the autopsy, that's almost immediately, that's when he was tortured to death, in the morning of March 12th, 1911. The nature of the wounds, 13 injections on the temple are unusual. It wasn't inflicted through a shirt, but he had been stripped first. It was a form of torture that was designed to completely bleed the body out. Very large number of wounds, I think 47 total. Unnecessary in ordinary, this is clearly no ordinary murder. The body was not hidden by criminals, but thrown unburied on the ground, as if to show the world, which, by the way, is typical of Jewish ritual murders. There is a surviving note from Bielis to his wife, transmitted through his cellmate, a guy by the name of Kazachenko. There's a promise of a reward for the poisoning of important witnesses who could confirm, those witnesses who confirm the children's testimony about the abduction. There are several pieces of clay soaked in blood stuck to the clothes of the murdered boy, similar in composition to the clay, right near the brick factory, which, as I mentioned, burned down mysteriously a very short time later. Staying there, now I'm talking about the brick factory here. I always thought the bricks are a symbolic place for this. I have the feeling they knew exactly what they were doing. There were two Jews who came from abroad who were seen wearing traditional religious vestments. And after the murder, they immediately left the country. A few days prior to the murder, there was a Hasidic synagogue laid at this plant, and it all happened that year, Passover, and the Jewish calendar was April 1st. You had this tremendous outcry amongst the Jews. The millionaire sugar magnate Brodsky created the Bielis Defense Committee, whose activities sometimes gave more evidence than they wanted to. If Bielis was innocent, then you don't need a massive lobbying campaign. You know, the whole point of a trial anywhere in the European world is to take this out of the hands of the public and put it in the hands of people who, in painstaking detail, have heard what we assume are the relevant facts of the case. So a defense committee, some of you, you know, that may ring familiar to some of you, is meant to subvert a trial. Now, after his arrest, the Jewish newspapers, as well as the legal team assigned to Bielis, came up with one story after another. And the stories, you know, were abandoned as soon as they were invented. The first one was that it was gypsies. Gypsies had killed the boy and did all this terrible thing. The second is his parents. That stuck around for a while. Parents and relatives murdered him, although they don't give a reason. Vera's neighbors. And then finally, her so-called gang of thieves. Guys around Vera, family members. And the court did not take them seriously. It didn't have any direct or indirect evidence behind it. Now, the defense committee, as you might imagine, was played dirty from the beginning. Their hysteria, inside and outside of Russia, this has never been known before. The declaration of war on Germany in 1933 was fairly mild compared to this. You had a member of the committee, Malkover, whose book I take a couple of facts from, who received copies of the interrogation protocols. The defense lawyer, Grigorovich Barsky, illegally received information, admitted to other members of the committee, and especially the chief defense counsel, Grusenberg, and that this information was sent to foreign powers. The American Jewish Committee, for example, a guy named Marshall, in a letter from Marshall to Rabbi Ginsburg, about the examination of one of the prosecutor's witnesses, Pronitis. And they fully admitted the full text of the examination. And they realized that, and this is way beyond, this isn't legitimate, this isn't discovery by any means, but things that they had absolutely no right to have. And of course, they had to spring into action. The two police officers initially involved, Krasovsky and Mishchuk, they initially led the search, even you know, the day he went missing, who did work, eventually were bribed and worked for the Jewish side, were fired and put on trial. However, they fled the country before this, fully admitting everything else. The head of the defense committee was the lawyer A.D. Margolin. Admitted that he bribed Vera Tereyakova to accept the blame for the murder. And she would be given 40,000 rubles, which is a huge sum at the time, and free passage out of the country. On the Jewish side, you had two men, Karayev and McCollin, who used very foul methods to extract confessions from others. The intimidation of witnesses was chronic throughout. As I mentioned, the destruction of the evidence at the factory. They constructed a new fence because the hole in the fence was important to the prosecution. And very little evidence remained. Remember the year here that this happened. I also mentioned the children. The Shabryakov children. Two died. Xenia, as I mentioned, Valia. And Ludmila was the only one who survived, although barely. Krasovsky, a Jew, part of that in the area, brought cakes. And these cakes were laced with poison. Very quickly after Bielis's arrest. Other witnesses, and like Pachalski, Zichenko, through whom the accused conveyed to his wife, as I mentioned before, a request to poison. I mentioned these guys, his cellmate and someone else, and these guys also disappeared. The coverage from the Jewish press is probably what you may expect. Deliberately false and manipulative coverage. Distorted facts. I mean, I have the entire transcript in Russian of the trial and nothing in the press, either in English or Russian, at the time even comes remotely close to. Just go to the Wikipedia article on it and see the nonsense that's taken as fact. You had every attempt to bias the jury. The persecution, violent acts against prosecution, experts, scholars, who were very important, endless threats, protests against the trial, boycotts, threats to burn down the city. Without knowing a single fact of the case, the so-called international community was issuing protest after protest. In Europe, they struck a bronze medal with Bielis's image on it. He became a cause celeb. He had diplomatic protests, foreign scholars. In fact, and the worst of all, you have the termination of the Russian-American trade agreement that was recently signed under pressure from the American Jewish Committee. And that's just the beginning of it. The scholarly literature is a disaster. Now, in the bibliography of the paper I'm putting together here, I have all of my sources in Russian. And it's probably a good idea to mention a few of them. His defense attorney, Guzenberg, I have from 1938. I mentioned Tager and Katsis, the Illinois Toxis, Blood Libel and Russian Thought. Margolin wrote The Jews of Eastern Europe, 1926. G.G. Domislavsky, Tormented by the Jews, the Saratov Case. That's a separate Ritual Murder Case. That was published in 1911. The materials of the Extraordinary Investigative Committee of the Provisional Government. You've heard me mention this before. They had a, after the Tsar was overthrown, they did a full investigation after the fact. And my edition of that came out in 1999. T.I. Butkevich on the meaning and significance of blood sacrifices in general. Vladimir Sokolov, Circumcision Amongst Jews, Historical and Theological Research. And I.B. Perantis, who I mentioned, his book, 1913, The Secret Blood, The Secret of Blood Amongst the Jews. And of course, my friend, Mikhail Nazarov, who helped compile the book, The Murder of Andrei of Kiev, The Bielis Case as a Jewish Show of Strength. S.I. Brzul Bruskovsky wrote The Truth About the Murder of Ushinsky in the Bielis Case in 1913. And I could go on, but that's the core Russian language sources that I use. So I need to mention, as I've already hinted at, that the Menshevik government, in my first book, I've mentioned this 100 times, the provisional government hired highly biased researchers to try to find issues of corruption concerning Rasputin and other things. And the Bielis case came up. And no matter how hard they tried, they came out with absolutely nothing. Jews showed their power, really one of the first times. No matter what they had to do, including murdering children, which they did, beyond, the other two, they spared no expense to shield the accused and hide the truth, which, in my mind, is indirect evidence of ritual murder. He was just, he was Hasidic, but he was a Jewish clerk. Hysterical worldwide campaign, and these lawyers cost a fortune. So the Bielis Defense Committee invited Grusenberg as the main legal counsel. And apparently he had experience in this matter. Another one, Blundis, another Jew, accused of murdering a Christian girl to obtain blood for ritual purposes. And he was acquitted. So bringing him into Kiev was also very expensive. Now, Margolin, member of the committee, did the research into other ritual trials. The beginning of 1912, the first indictment didn't say anything about the ritual nature of this murder. He was accused of brutal torture and murder for the purpose of extracting blood for some reason. But the question about the ritual could only have been read really between the lines, if only by the nature and pattern of the wounds on the victim's body. The slow murder, very deliberate, almost professionally done for the sake of, there was no blood in his body when they found him, and no blood on the ground. So clearly, this was done elsewhere and done with a certain skill. The Jews initially thought maybe they should just stay silent and ignore all of these facts, but that's not what happened. I want to quote, many of you know Jabotinsky, one of the most militant Zionists around at the time. He wrote a paper called Instead of an Apology in 1911. And this wasn't just about this particular case. And he wrote this right after the arrest of Bielis, but this had been happening. I want to quote him directly. He's one of the most militant Jews of the day. The Jewish defender's arguments are as monotonous as the accusations of the other side. It's the same thing from century to century. First, it is proven the Jewish faith forbids the consumption of blood. Then comes the proof that most famous ritual processes, legal processes, has always ended in triumph of the truth, the acquittal of the innocent, and the disgrace of the slanderers. But the crowd doesn't listen to these arguments. To the list of acquittals, they answer, the Jews bribed the court. To the list of texts prohibiting the consumption of blood, they answer, that means there's another text that allows it. You don't want to quote it. For several years, Jews in Russia have been firmly in the dock. It's not their fault. But here is what is undeniably their fault. They behave like defendants. Who are we to justify ourselves to them? Who are they to interrogate us? Whether we like us or not is in the end indifferent. Whether we're liked is indifferent. If you've never had a ritual murder, but let them believe as much as they want. We don't care and we shouldn't be embarrassed, for the Jewish nation is a royal one and is not subject to criminal responsibility and is not obligated to justify itself to non-Jews. That was at least one faction of Jewish opinion. The royal people are superior to the goyim, so you cannot judge us. He did admit that the evidence was pretty rough against him, but he says, well, you could always find Jews to fake it. So here he is attacking those who believed in the ritual murder for these rhetorical, you know, errors, and yet he says the same thing. But then he even says, if it is true, well, you can't talk about Jewry on the grounds of some crazy person. But that's in their minds. The Russian press was owned by Jews. The press in Kiev had zero non-Jewish editors at the time. So in Katz's book, who is a modern Jewish specialist in this case, and ritual murder in general, he takes Jabotinsky very seriously, and he did as well, that they have something to defend themselves from. But in the act of being a defendant, which is what, you know, he condemns, it's implied that there's something to defend against, and that's something that they couldn't handle. So Jabotinsky wanted the quiet response. If they debate the issue, it gives credence to the accusation. There was no stress on the ritual nature of the murder. In fact, it was a deliberate policy in St. Petersburg and elsewhere that the governor of Kiev himself, the region himself, didn't want violence against Jews, so they kept some of this quiet. Grusenberg, the chief defense attorney, disagreed with that approach and absolutely thought this was a dangerous situation. The myth that they created, the powerlessness of the Jews in the face of ignorant goyim, he saw this as nothing but bad, no matter what happens. The signs of the ritual murder were very obvious, and you can't just silently avoid it. Because even if Bielis is acquitted, this myth will remain and questions will remain. And that was Grusenberg's logic. Little did he know that in 100 years, Jewish control would be such that even bringing this up can lead to prison sentences. Jewry had this overwhelming financial, political, and even informational power. He took the opposite approach and wanted to demand that the prosecutor provide evidence convincing to the jury, and even theological evidence of religious ritual murder, which of course was not really the issue as far as legality is concerned. Over and over again, the defense committee said that Russians and Ukrainians on the jury are ignorant. They don't know anything. All this, you know, how dare you judge us? Because the ritual issue was not in Russian law, he was simply tried in capital murder. The press, however, you know, brought up the ritual question, as well as the pathologist. And it wasn't just Jews, of course. All of progressive humanity, so-called, was rising up against anti-Semitic Russia. And Grusenberg, part of his defense was the mobilization of liberals, leftists, communists, and Jews around the world. The first indictment didn't mention any ritual element. They really couldn't. Now, despite that, the trial got very deep into theology, because you have to have a motive. Now, you don't need a motive to convict anybody. But for a jury, they're quite interested. You know, why did he do this? What was the point of going through all this trouble? So it ended up being a battle between experts. the idea that Judaism prohibits the use of blood in all cases versus the opposite. Now, Grusenberg brought up the question of bringing experts in, and he was initially refused on the grounds that there was no mention of ritual murder in the indictment. A lawyer by the name of Shemakov, who was Andrusov's mother's lawyer in the civil case, he thought this was a good idea. But at this stage, the judge permitted it so long as it sticks to the issue of evidence for guilt or not guilt. In other words, here you have a modern trial, high level, followed by almost everyone in the world at the time, getting into the Talmud, Kabbalistic Judaism. But when it came to motive, this came up over and over again, despite the fact the judge made it clear this only has to be connected with evidence, not theology as such. Another lawyer, Karabchevsky, tried to limit the scope of the discussion, but the question was raised and there's no going back there. They didn't want a broad discussion of the nature of ritual murder, because really that's only about motive, not really about the law as such. It's about convincing the jury. But Grusenberg underestimated the danger of this strategy. As it turns out, the debate, two sides of experts, didn't go the Jewish way. Their experts actually did a very bad job. So they brought in religious experts for his defense. Troitsky, Kokovtsov, Tikhomirov, Rabbi Meiser, they failed miserably. These guys all admitted their ignorance of many important facts. They didn't know much about the Zohar. They didn't know much about at least most of the Talmud. They didn't know much about the Saratov case. The prosecution did mention the disputes, the two disputes between anti-Talmudic rabbis and Talmudists in 1757 and 1759. And in the book I've cited from before, Greats, the Talmudists were defeated. And they didn't even manage to justify themselves from the accusations of drinking Christian blood. That actually came up. Professor Troitsky, of course, denied the existence of ritual murders at all, had to admit that there is a possibility of a sect that's into this sort of thing, prompted by religious fanaticism. Then he says, I'm not familiar with any of this. I don't have the documents with me. And then at the end, he admitted, he said, I admit murders with the aim of mocking the religion of Christians. I admit this. I admit this at least regarding the baby Gabriel Belostok, who was another ritual murderer who's been a victim who's been canonized. They brought in a priest, Glagolev, took the exact same position, saying that, well, there's no clear teaching on this regard, but that doesn't mean that there's not malicious superstition going on. He was the other expert, Professor Tikhomirov, not the great Tikhomirov, was confronted with evidence from the Talmud. Remember, this isn't a public trial here. He was forced to admit, I'm going to quote him directly here. He says, indeed, the Talmud contains such diverse material that whoever wants to find something will find everything. In other words, it's in there, but it's because it's so big, how dogmatic can it possibly be? So, one of his lawyers, he had many, Maklakov, at the end of the trial, I'm going to quote him again here, perhaps they were fanatics. They could be everywhere. They could be amongst the Jews, which they didn't want to have to say. They maintained the impossibility of ritual murders. Let me give you another example, the statement of the rabbis of Russia. Let me quote from that as part of this defense committee, almost like an amicus brief. They say, with indignation, we reject the accusation that there is a sect or individuals among Jews who use Christian blood for ritual purposes. Jewish law in its entirety, immutable, indivisible, has no variations. There are no sects in Jewry. Our religion does not and could not provide grounds for bloody fanaticism. The Hasidics do not constitute a sect. They have the same law, the same instructions and rituals, down to the smallest detail, and all of which is obligatory. They deny that the Hasidim were a sect within Jewry. Now, L.A. Tikhomirov, the great Tikhomirov, who wrote The Court and the Crowd in the Bielis case, he said, quote, "Not a single people, not a single religion protests against the right and duty of the investigation to sort through all hypotheses about the cause of a crime. Some Jews and their adherents allow themselves the absurd demand to not allow the very assumption of the liturgical nature of murder. Don't they understand that this only casts suspicion on the Jews?" The prosecution had its own list of experts here. They were not allowed, by decree of the judge, to get into the spiritual meaning of ritual murder. Again, it had to be immediately connected with the evidence against Bielis, despite the fact that this is evidentiary. They limited themselves largely to interpretation of the ritual itself relative to what they found, but they couldn't get too deep into it. So Rosenberg, then the defense, said, "You know, this is unprovable," which really was not the full issue, because there was no question that this kid was murdered, and we have witnesses putting Bielis at the core of it. I'm going to quote the chief defense attorney, Rosenberg, here. An answer to the question posed by the jury, which you can do. The announced question included a reference to the savage motives of the defendant. In March 1906, the wording "savage murder" was abolished by the law. Thus, in reference made to the question to savage motives is no longer provided. The Senate clarified that in the question of the event of a crime, it is necessary to avoid the slightest indication of subjective signs. What else, if not a subjective sign that is related to the author of a crime, but not to the criminal act, can be called a reference to religious motives? How quickly they're going to abandon that later on. You can't even talk about the savagery of the crime, because savagery is not a legal category. And yet, clearly, it's connected to motive, etc. The main goal of the Jews here, just to continually pound on the fact that this is a political issue, not it has nothing to do with the trial. They tried to avoid some of the evidence that I've already mentioned. They believed, and internationally, that this man was innocent because they said it's impossible for ritual murder to ever be the case. Now, another question to the jury. What the jury agreed to was this. The premises of the brick factory owned by the Jewish hospital run by the merchant, Mark Zatya, 13-year-old Andriy Yasinski, with his mouth clamped, inflicted with a stabbing instrument on the parietal, occipital, and temporal regions, as well as the neck, accompanied by injuries to the cerebral vein, arteries of the left temple, neck veins, which resulted in profuse bleeding. And then, when Yasinski bled out the amount up to several pints, he was again inflicted with the same weapon in the torso, injuries to the lungs, liver, right kidney, heart, and the area, which the last blows were directed, which amounts in their totality to 47, causing agony, and it entailed almost complete bleeding of the body and its death. And the jury said, "Yes, it is proven, we accept that." Now, when it came to planning, agreeing with a conspiracy, trying to avoid the investigation out of motives of religious fanaticism, they said, "No, we can't demonstrate that." Now, the judge said prior to the jury deliberation, he said, "If you admit that this murder was committed at the Zaitsev plant, then you would have to discuss the situation as to whether this murder could have been committed without the participation of Bielis." And of course, you have the testimony of the children, their sudden death. Now, he was acquitted. And it's not just because of witnesses dying, also refusal of testimony. The enormous pressure put on this judge, put on jurors, by the press. There wasn't much from the Orthodox side, really, the so-called progressive public and global opinion. His defense attorney brought this up. His defense attorney said, you know, the entire world is against you and will destroy you if you vote to convict. During the trial, proof of these physical threats from the Jewish side, the plans to poison witnesses, the sudden death of many people involved with the case, especially the children, the disappearance of the others, Kazachenko, who I mentioned already. I'm not sure how these guys were supposed to act, but all this came out. Did the jury, admitting what happened, admitting that Bielis had something to do with it, still, that's like in the case of Ira Zasulich, who was also acquitted. Did they make the decision based on fear? It exposed all of the means that the Jews used to destroy the legal process, because they saw it as an accusation about Jewry as a whole, which it didn't have to be. They brought that up. But the impression was made that they're covering something up. There was another one in Czechia, the Czech Republic, within the Austrian Empire, in 1899, a guy named Gulzner. He was sentenced twice to death for an actual ritual murder. I'm sorry, for the murder, but not a ritual murder. And during the revolution, of course, the Jews, you know, freed him. The Saratov case, which lasted from 1853 to 1860, the ritual murder of boys was indisputably established. The criminals were sentenced to hard labor. But the question of the ritual issue was through secret intrigue, taken out of the verdict. And that's the basis on which they said there's no objective evidence for this kind of thing. They simply invented an entire narrative. Reading the trial documents gives a very, very different story. This is why, ultimately, he was acquitted. They pass off this gang of thieves as the true one, despite having no motive, and there's no witnesses that people around the woman's may have done something like this. Going so far as to say that the Tsarist government, who was not involved in this, in fact, there really was nobody around Tsar Nicholas who believed him guilty. Or at least, it's not good for us for him to be guilty. When it did come out that this was actually a ritual, and all the symbolism was discussed, the only response was it was staged by the Tsarist government. And I mentioned the Extraordinary Investigative Commission of the Provisional Government under the control of Nikolai Muravyov, who was a Freemason. He interrogated 48 people a few years later, and he couldn't find any evidence of any of the Jewish claims here. Now, what is the official point of view on this case, especially in the Soviet era? And this is from Tager, who I mentioned already. He says that the Bielis case was aimed at delaying, disintegrating, paralyzing the growing workers' revolutionary movement through nationalist pogrom persecution, creating an atmosphere poisoned by anti-Semitism. He says, without exception, all the evidence presented by the authorities to support the accusation was forged. The entire undertaking had from the beginning to end the support and approval of the Tsar himself. Thus, the alliance of the gangs that killed Yushinsky with the straight prosecutor's office, commanding organization of the United Nobility, was headed by the royal figure. And yet, in his own memoirs, Grusenberg says there was not a single person in the immediate circle of the monarch who was not convinced of Bielis' innocence. There was zero evidence that the monarchy had anything to do with this case. There is zero evidence that it was staged. And by saying it was staged, you know, and somehow this is going to have something to do with forestalling the communist revolution, you see how close this case was to the Bolsheviks and the Jewish Bund and other revolutionary groups. Anytime there was any anti-Soviet agitation, revolutionaries would say, it's another Bilas case. They said that over and over again. Even Orthodox people at the time said that this was a police setup, judicial provocation, assuming that the real murderers were local guys in the area, Rudzinski, Latyshev, claiming that Vera poisoned her own children, fearing that they would, you know, spill the beans. None of this had any evidence behind it. None of this came up in the trial whatsoever. But the broader point, one of the experts from the prosecution, Professor Sikorsky, who fully accepts the idea of the possibility of ritual murder concerning the method of execution, the choice of victims. They don't necessarily have to kill the victim. There's bloodletting. There's some deviation from the rule that Hasidics were particularly superstitious. Blood sacrifice was very common. The fact that this young man wanted to be a priest is not lost on me. Now, because the Jews rejected Christ, they had no choice but to continue the animal sacrifices in order to appease who they call God and to receive his help. Because he was a young man, he was still innocent, a male without blemish, like you see in Leviticus. The Jews sacrifice a rooster on the Day of Atonement in the place of the Jew himself. Because there's no temple anymore for sacrifices, they don't think really it's necessary anymore that the ancient law on sacrifices, especially the aggressive wars of Yahweh and Deuteronomy, was supplemented in the Talmud by the religious point of view that the goyim are not people. In fact, they are animals, and therefore killing them is not considered a crime. There's a Jewish Kabbalist, Chaim Vital, and he said, talking about blood sacrifices and jewelry, he said, every animal preserves through life a certain particle of holiness of the Most High. When you kill an animal, then the shadow of holiness leaves it and turns in favor of the one who eats from this animal. By killing and drinking the blood of an infidel goyim, the holiness of Israel is increased. If the goyim, especially in Russia, of all places in Russia, are in humans, this is a part of the sacrifice, especially an innocent boy who wanted to become a priest. But they were very sloppy. You know, in the Talmud, what are we called? Akum, or idolaters. Of course, goyim, Edomites, Nokri, or strangers, Notrim, Nazarenes, Kuti, Canaanites, whatever. Many other names with the direct instruction to kill them. Kill the best of the goyim, or whoever sheds the blood of the wicked is pleasing to God, as he who makes a sacrifice to him. Many examples throughout the Talmud. Now, I mentioned the public debate in Lvov in 1757 and 1759, between the Talmudic rabbis and the anti-Talmudic rabbis, or the Frankists. The latter directly accused the former of ritual murder and drinking the blood of Christians. The anti-Talmudic rabbis in that debate said, you guys are guilty on occasion of this ritual murder. The defense expert I mentioned already, Troitsky, he said, I must say that in the Talmud, there are expressions that give reason to accuse the Talmudists of complete intolerance and misanthropy. The blasphemy of which some of them I cannot deny. Now, the concept of the ransoming of the firstborn, not, you know, the Passover concept, not to mention the Purim holiday, the holiday of the murder of 75,000 anti-Semites, and connecting that with Passover. You know, in Exodus chapter 12, that each Israelite family had to sacrifice a lamb. And of course, you brush the blood on your porch near the door, and the angel of death passes over. Now, of course, in Russia, Jews considered themselves in Egyptian slavery. The concept of the lamb was part of what accompanied the flight of the Jews from Egypt. The matzah for the holiday is made according to a ritual as a remembrance of the unleavened bread in the desert, fleeing Egypt. And it's made ritually in one central place, and it's given out to everyone else. The fact that these cases always show up on Passover, also because of Christ's murder, as this kind of imitation, you put all this together, and you have a theological foundation, at least among the extreme Hasidim. And they may have no idea, many Jews have no idea that this may exist. The healing properties of blood, the Hasidic superstitions, not so much that it's medicinal, but it's a ritual and mystical approach to blood where the soul is said to reside. It's not entirely the case that blood is forbidden for consumption. But we're not talking about food, we're talking about symbolic use for ritual purposes. Now, the priest collected the blood of animals slain in the Jerusalem temple into vessels, ritually spilled it over the main shrine, the Ark of the Covenant, etc. Blood was a huge part of these sacrifices and these rituals. So a butcher in Judaism isn't a butcher in our sense, but a respected religious person, like a moa, performing circumcision, a moil. During the ritual circumcision of boys, the imitation of the sacrifice of a baby to the Jewish god or themselves, the blood is sucked out of the penis by the mouth, collected in a vessel with water, and those present must, with a prayer to their god, wash themselves with this blood water. Christian victims are precisely the lamb that they want to slaughter. Among Jews, blood is forbidden to be consumed as ordinary food precisely because it's considered a liturgical object. It has a more important purpose. Pavel Florensky wrote in a letter to Rozanov, he said, blood removed from culinary circulation is withdrawn precisely because it is preserved for the most sacred moments. Thus, in many cults, a certain animal is certainly forbidden to believers and is surrounded by all sorts of prohibitions. It cannot be killed, it cannot be eaten. But at certain times and periods, it is slaughtered in a sacred way and liturgically eaten. The blood of the goyim, also animal, should probably be considered just this kind of forbidden food in ordinary times. But I willingly admit that very few, only the chosen ones in Judaism, are initiated into this secret. Vladimir Dahl gives several examples, great Russian nationalist researcher back then, quoted a few Jewish books that permit the consumption of blood, not as food. But in the Shulchan Aruch, page 42, article 67, the blood of cattle and animals cannot be used for food, but human blood for our benefit can be used. Within the Talmud, several at the trial quoted that blood is counted among the same pure drinks as milk, water, wine, etc. And exactly how to drink it, to pierce a certain blood vessel, not from cutting, exactly as was the case with this poor boy. Blood is of tremendous importance, and the defense admitted this. And it can be consumed internally if it's prescribed, for example. It's also allowed for food in boiled form. That means mixing of blood, however small, in the matzah is not a ritual prohibition. Eating it is an important religious ritual. Jewish law gives blood in general, and human blood in particular, extraordinary significance, symbolic, almost magical. Now, all of these meanings are combined within this Jewish mentality, either symbolically, but on occasion, it comes out in a literal way. The Nathanite monk, Neil Phytos, who was a former rabbi, talks about the importance of blood in Jewish rituals, especially in circumcision, that this blood is done for some mystical unity. As they say, his blood be on us and on our children, binding them together, the collective eating of matzah prepared for Passover, the Passover lamb, So at the same time, they collect the blood of the lamb and sprinkle it on the doorpost and the lintels of the house, in which people who perform the sacrifice will eat the meat of the lamb. It unites the Jews as a people, according to Rabbi Hirsch. He says the Paschal sacrifice is necessary not only to consolidate the connection of Jews with the Almighty, it is also necessary in order to unite the Jews themselves into a people. Now, of course, these traditions are maintained through the Talmud and Zohar, orally, for the most part, not known to many Jews. But during the trial, the testimony of Pronatius, Butkevich, and others quoted Jewish books talking about the so-called dogma of blood, certain encrypted allegorical passages, the use of Christian blood in some of their work during Passover. It's no shock that the demons whom they worship, these murderers from the beginning, that they require human sacrifice. I mean, it's an integral element of satanic magic. One of the scholars that they use, a guy named the Professor Volson, admitted ritual murders among the Semites and Chaldean magicians. And then he also admits that it was for Talmudic Judaism a source for some of their ideas. Same thing for Pavel Florensky. The use of magic spells and the use of human blood mentioned as by the enemies of the church, Ezekiel 21, Zechariah 10. And of course, this fully contradicts the Old Testament. But so does everything in modern Jewry. And it couldn't be preached. This was something that was held not just among Jews, but a tiny group of the initiated. The blood sacrifice is a way for the most extreme to mechanize and ritualize their domination over the Goyim. It's very significant that they prove their immense power. Even in the Talmud, though, their God, quote-unquote, is a capricious, a passion-ridden being who can't rule without the help of the wise Jews who are equal, if not superior, to him. Even their leaders are infallible and can even control this God who does nothing without their input. And that justifies all crimes against non-Jews. It took a while for the Haredi to be accepted in Judaism, but this is part of the end times, the satanic kingdom, the restructuring of the fallen world by and into Adam Kadmon, the synthetic synagogue, as it's called. This is about consolidating Jews as a nation, comprising the so-called Almighty. So, there's some very good theological reason to believe that among an extreme sect, this sort of thing is possible. Since they adopted the so-called theology of the Chaldeans and Mesopotamians and their successors, this concern with blood, not just in the Old Testament sense, but in the magical sense, is extremely important. The fact that they used it, the blood to ward off the angel of death. So too the sacrifice of this human goy, pure, without spot, without blemish, loved by everybody, cements their domination. This case demonstrated without a shadow of a doubt, exposed the crime, the disinformation, the lies, the bribery, murder of witnesses. This exposed the Jews at the elite levels for what they really are, internationally speaking. It also revealed the hostility towards Russia from the liberal world in the West, controlled by Jewish money. Even before World War I, the anti-Semitic Orthodox Russia was condemned, even by their so-called allies. It connected Jews to leftist and anti-royalist propaganda and mobilized all anti-Russian forces all over the globe, especially the media. It also revealed a schism in Russian society that the Russian nationalists, Orthodox nationalists, were overwhelmed by the pro-Jewish intellectuals. And if you read the press treatments, the murder of this child was hardly mentioned. It was just establishing the innocently persecuted Jew, making some of these Russian intellectuals an accomplice. It also revealed how unprepared the empire was for this massive attack from the West and the world's wealthy. Most of the crimes of the Jewish side related to the Kiev trial, you know, intimidation, bribery, were never brought up again. But it also exposed the weakness of the spiritual authorities, or the church in Russia, which in this passionate sea didn't speak out about what this was and what was going on. They didn't answer the Globe's press. Either they didn't know, or they didn't want to come under the same attack. Murdering this kid doesn't even come up. That wasn't the point. It's the Jews themselves who made this whole thing about them as a unit. The defense attorney even said, this is Russia committing suicide, and explains the ritual murder of Tsar Nicholas II in the same way. To think that it's forbidden for Jews to use blood for a tiny little bit in the matzah recipe is absurd. It's just not true. And the defense had to admit that. That the adoption of the cabal of the pagan methods of the Chaldeans, blood and human sacrifice are a huge part of it. But they're, at least at the time, living in the Russian Orthodox world and the royalist world. They couldn't get away with much. And it's surprising they were pretty, sloppy in this regard. They knew at some level that they had the power behind them. The so-called secret teachings of Moses in the Kabbalah. The concept of blood is all over the Talmud. And how it can be used. Ultimately, the draining of blood is for mixing with the Passover matzah. The prosecution witnesses did a very good job of bringing this up, however, in a tempered way because of the nature of the instructions from the judge. Pavel Florinsky, many others at the time, realized what was going on here. And from that point of view, it makes sense that this innocent boy who wanted to be a priest is a sacrifice, almost like the sacrifice of a virgin in the old pagan ways. This was the first step in the Bolshevik Revolution. This was the war against Tsarist Russia, which had been around for a while, but this deepened it, brought the Jews almost unanimously to hate Russia and the monarchy. It's not a matter of whether or not Bielus was innocent or guilty. I think he was guilty. They may have thought he was guilty. That's not the point. The interests of the Jews, how dare they judge us? How dare they bring this up? They are our inferiors. They are animals. And therefore, we cannot commit a crime against them. That's the mentality then, and that's the mentality now. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.